This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. Well, Brad has now tested positive for COVID, so today's Bradcast was originally recorded on June 4th, 2024.
Do not be seduced by easy equalization. There is nothing equal about this equation. We are at an existential crossroads in our political and civic lives. This is a choice that could not be clearer.
Oh, well, I'm with Ken Burns on that one. Gotta say.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Hey. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle, Washington. Interesting story out of Seattle, Washington today, I hope. On KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today, and welcome to the Bradcast, which we are, just happy to be able to bring to you today at all, given Desi's lingering rebound COVID case, which seems to be getting better. Thanks for asking, and the notes of concern we've got from folks.
Yes, thank you. I am feeling better.
All
I
right.
don't sound like I am, but I am.
Yeah, well, we'll see how you feel at the end of this show. And, of course, there was a full internet outage out here in our part of Los Angeles overnight and much of this morning. So we're sort of flying without an engine or two, but hopefully we'll be able to stay in and on the air over the next hour when we hope to conclude with our latest Green News report after a week off and a wild week, frankly, of climate catastrophes around both the nation and the world, even though that's becoming pretty routine at this point, it seems to me, Des.
Yes, it is, but it doesn't make it any less important.
So we will start here. Voters headed to the primary polls on Tuesday in five states, Iowa, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, and South Dakota, as well as the District of Columbia, where some are holding presidential primaries. Most are holding congressional primaries. And a few are also holding state and local primaries on Tuesday. I'm happy to report we have not yet, anyway, seen too many problems for voters at the polls or with the voting systems, though what is being described as a, quote, programming glitch on touchscreen ES&S machine. Why are you laughing, Des?
Because it's always a glitch.
I know,
like, oh, you know.
It's a glitch. It's a hiccup. It's a snag.
Instead
it's a
of
snafu.
A failure. Instead of a failure.
Correct. That would be on touchscreen, and it's often on the touchscreen machines. This is during early voting. Touchscreen systems made by ES&S in New Jersey, where that programming glitch by ES&S, the nation's largest voting system vendor, resulted in some voters in Wildwood Crest District 3 in New Jersey being given ballots for Wildwood District 3 with no Crest. That during early voting, the problem was thankfully discovered only when one of the affected early voters turned out to be a county Democratic chair who went to vote for herself last week and could not find her own name for a county committee seat on the ballot.
Well, that's a hell of a check.
We will share any further reported problems as they may occur and or noteworthy reported results from the actual elections as they are available on our next broadcast. But there are some other concerns of note for Democrats in New Jersey today. The state's U.S. Senator Robert Menendez, a lifelong Democrat, filed paperwork on Monday to run for re-election as an independent this November. Well, he didn't personally file the paperwork at the Department of State in Trenton, New Jersey on Monday. Some men did it for him, reportedly, because he is in the fourth week of a massive federal corruption and bribery trial against him and his wife, who are both accused of receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash and gold bars and a Mercedes-Benz in exchange for actions taken on behalf of foreign governments while serving as the chair of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The indictment charges, among other things, that Menendez agreed to help Egypt's government with weapons sales and financing in exchange for help to get his then-girlfriend, now his wife, a high-paying job. The 70-year-old former Senate Foreign Relations Committee chair faced widespread calls within the Democratic Party to resign after he and his wife Nadine were charged with obstruction of justice and bribery offenses. Menendez comfortably won re-election back in 2018 as a Democrat, despite earlier felony charges against him that he was largely able to dodge. So his decision now to run as an independent this year, well, that could prove to be a headache for the Democratic Party in what has typically been a safe Senate seat for Democrats in New Jersey, said Menendez in a statement to media upon filing to run for his seat as an independent, quote, "It displeases me to have to go this route, thanks to overzealous prosecutors, but I will do what must be done to continue to uphold my oath of office for my constituents. As I have said before, I have committed no crime," he continued. "I am more confident than ever that New Jerseyans and the rest of the American public will see me exonerated of what I am being accused of, and I will be reelected to the Senate once again." Now, while that seems somewhat ridiculous, frankly, given the mountain of evidence that prosecutors have compiled against him that's included in the indictment alone, he was actually somewhat exonerated during a different federal corruption indictment some years ago following a mistrial on those charges in 2017 and then an acquittal on several of the charges in a retrial in 2018. After that, the Trump Department of Justice dropped the remaining charges against Menendez before he then went on to win re-election, despite all of the indictments and the trials, et cetera, later that same year. The New Jersey Globe first reported that Menendez was circulating petitions to get onto this year's ballot as an independent, in some cases, apparently gathering signatures on his own. NBC News reported late last week that Menendez had obtained the 800 signatures that is needed to get on the ballot. Apparently, that's all that's required to get on the U.S. Senate ballot in New Jersey.
Wow, that's not very many.
He turned over something like 2,500. So we will see if those signatures hold up. The New Jersey Globe confirmed that Menendez has no campaign staff and is managing his own race. 4 days before the March 26 filing deadline for the Democratic primary in the state, which is happening, what's happening on Tuesday, Menendez announced that he would not enter that primary, but he made clear he was considering a re-election campaign as an independent Democrat if he was exonerated by the jury. His criminal trial is expected to last for another 4 weeks, but entering the race now, notes the New Jersey Globe, now preserves his option to make a final decision after a verdict is handed down. the specter of the 70-year-old Menendez trying to mount a comeback campaign, according to the New York Times, raises the possibility of a splintered Democratic vote in November's election if he remains on the ballot by then, rather than dropping out, if, as he suggests, he might if he, you know, if the jury finds him guilty. But it does create a wider lane for the Republican nominee at a time when Democrats are struggling to retain a very narrow majority in the U.S. Senate. Menendez has been abandoned by most of the state's leading Democrats, who quickly called on him to resign after he was indicted again last year. He refused to step down, however, though he opted not to run in Tuesday's Democratic primary. He never shut the door, however, to running as an independent. And here is the critical part. Running as an independent enables him to continue to raise and spend campaign contributions on lawyers hired to defend him and his wife.
Bingo.
She is also charged in the bribery conspiracy. And the trial is likely to last for another month, but he has until the middle of August to withdraw, apparently, from the November 5 election this fall. The Democratic front runner for his seat, Congressman Andy Kim, was quick to criticize the senator's entry into the race as selfish. He said, quote, "Everyone knows Bob Menendez isn't running for New Jersey families. He is running for himself." Several Republicans were competing for the Senate nomination in Tuesday's primary, but registered Democrats far outnumber Republicans in New Jersey by more than 900,000 voters. And it has been a half century since the left-leaning state has elected a Republican to the U.S. Senate. But hey, this could be the year if Menendez actually continues with his run. It's unclear, the Times notes, how he would successfully run a campaign with no paid campaign staff and a rapidly dwindling campaign war chest, but perhaps winning that seat is not the goal. Meanwhile, state polls show that roughly 75% of New Jersey residents are already convinced that Menendez is guilty of the charges, and an equal percentage say they disapprove of his performance in the Senate, making his odds of winning as an independent even longer. After court on Monday, Menendez confirmed that he had personally collected signatures. He also reiterated that he expected to be exonerated and said he thought the trial was going well. He said, quote, "We are discrediting the government's witnesses," adding in Spanish to a question posed by a Spanish-speaking reporter, quote, "We are turning them into our witnesses, and we're showing our innocence." Of course, that's what Donald Trump said about the witnesses in his case. But anyway, listen, innocent until proven guilty, right? Even when the FBI finds tens of thousands of dollars in cash and gold bars stuffed into the pockets of your clothing in your closets at home during a raid. So, you know, thanks for putting the nation first, Bob. That nation, of course, being Egypt in this case. I should note here that the charges being brought against, you know, a sitting and once powerful Democratic U.S. Senator, Bob Menendez, just like the corruption charges recently filed against sitting Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar of Texas, are being brought by the federal government, the Department of Justice. That would be Joe Biden's Department of Justice, the one that Donald Trump and all of his Republican sycophants in Congress keep telling you has been, quote, weaponized by Joe Biden to go after Republicans. Really? Obviously, that is a lie. But that has not prevented House Republicans from pretending otherwise and using their platform of holding the majority barely in the U.S. House to demand documents from the Justice Department on ongoing investigations and cases and threatening Attorney General Merrick Garland with contempt of Congress criminal charges if he does not comply with these demands. Today, in one of the House Republicans' fake weaponization of justice hearings in the GOP-controlled House Judiciary Committee, Attorney General Garland, who was called for testimony, pushed back at the effort by Republicans, which he says has resulted in, among other things, death threats to federal law enforcement officials.
This effort is only the most recent in a long line of attacks on the Justice Department's work. It comes alongside threats to defund particular department investigations, most recently the special counsel's prosecution of the former president. It comes alongside false claims that a jury verdict in a state trial brought by a local district attorney was somehow controlled by the Justice Department. That conspiracy theory is an attack on the judicial process itself. It comes as individual career agents and prosecutors have been singled out just for doing their jobs. It comes as baseless and extremely dangerous falsehoods are being spread about the FBI's law enforcement operations. And it comes at a time when we are seeing heinous threats of violence being directed at the Justice Department's career civil servants. These repeated attacks on the Justice Department are unprecedented and they are unfounded. These attacks have not and they will not influence our decision making. I view contempt as a serious matter, but I will not jeopardize the ability of our prosecutors and agents to do their jobs effectively in future investigations. I will not be intimidated, and the Justice Department will not be intimidated. We will continue to do our jobs free from political influence, and we will not back down from defending democracy.
That was Attorney General Merrick Garland in the U.S. House on Tuesday. And among the attacks that he refers to against federal law enforcement officials are attacks that come on the heels of Donald Trump falsely claiming that the FBI attempted to assassinate him during their execution of a search warrant down in Mar-a-Lago, where they found thousands of pages of classified documents that Donald Trump had stolen when he left office and refused to give back. And Donald Trump put that out there, literally saying, quote, the FBI was locked and loaded during the raid and that it was an attempt to assassinate him, even though Donald Trump was not actually at Mar-a-Lago at the time of this search warrant execution.
I mean, it's not only a lie, it's a dumb lie.
It's also, this hearing comes at the exact same time that Robert Menendez is facing a massive federal corruption trial brought by, yes, Merrick Garland and Joe Biden's, I guess, Department of Justice. And a Democrat, a highly ranked Democratic U.S. senator and a Democratic congressman, Henry Cuellar, down in Texas. Not to mention, of course, the son of the president of the United States, Hunter Biden, on gun charges in Delaware. Federal charges that, by the way, I'll tell you what, if the Department of Justice is weaponized against Republicans, it's really doing a lousy job of its weaponization. Joe Biden, he also could have pardoned his own son, just like, Donald Trump would have done had his own son been charged with anything at all. So the weaponization of the Justice Department to go after Republicans, obviously it is a lie. Obviously, that is completely untrue, and obviously, I should not even have to point that out. But given the constant, repeated, unending lies by Donald Trump and his lackeys in Congress and everywhere else, it needs to be repeated. You need to repeat it to the MAGA dupes and patsies and chumps and suckers in your life, the ones that you likely know, that you likely run into. Since these persistent lies are not going to debunk themselves, and Lord knows Democrats are nowhere near as aggressive as they need to be in rebutting these lies. So yeah, it is up to you and it is up to me. And by you and me, I don't mean just me. I mean you too. Because as we frequently say, this democracy is not going to save itself. It's going to need all of us playing a part this year at a moment in our nation's history that has never been as perilous, at least not since the Civil War. Yeah, we had some good news last week regarding accountability for Donald Trump with his 34 criminal felony convictions in New York related to his successful attempt to rig the 2016 election. But that's just the beginning of accountability. And Trump and his autocratic fascist thugs are working very, very hard right now to unwind it all in the courts, in Congress, and of course, in this year's elections, where if Trump wins, most, if not all, of any accountability gained will simply go away. Because he will have the power at that point to make it go away. And do you think for a second he would not use that power? Of course he would. That's why he's running for president in the first place. It ain't because he gives a damn about the nation. He's running to save himself. Period. End of story. And that will come with, by the way, retribution and revenge against all of those who called him out for his crimes. So, yeah, this is damned serious. Therefore, it's also good news to see still more charges, more accountability being brought against his lackeys who attempted to steal the 2020 election. And we had a bit more of that today up in Wisconsin, where Attorney General Josh Call, yes, a Democrat, brought felony charges on Tuesday against three one-time advisors of former President Donald Trump, the ones who devised and helped implement the fake electors plot up there in 2020, a plot which was then subsequently expanded to be carried out in about half a dozen battleground states. So Wisconsin on Tuesday became the fifth battleground state to prosecute Trump allies and or Trump himself for their failed attempt to overturn his defeat that year by attempting to steal the election from Joe Biden and the American people with this fake elector plot. Kenneth Chesbro, sometimes known as Cheesebro, was one of the architects, the first architect, actually, of the Trump campaign, the Trump campaign plot to impanel slates of bogus electors in several states that Trump lost. He was named as one of the defendants on Tuesday in Wisconsin. The other men charged were James Troupas, a former state judge in Wisconsin who was working for the campaign up there, and Michael Roman, a GOP operative who served as Trump's director of Election Day operations. All three face, at least at this point, one single count of forgery, which is a felony in Wisconsin, carrying a penalty of up to 6 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. Prosecutors cast the three defendants as trying to use the alleged forgery of Wisconsin's Electoral College votes to overthrow the results of the 2020 election. That, the complaint says, was done along with senior, unnamed for now anyway, Trump campaign officials. Prosecutors cited text messages and other records that Chesbro provided while he was cooperating with state prosecutors as part of the case. But though Chesbro had agreed to cooperate in the investigations in several different states after he had pleaded guilty to a felony charge in Georgia, information emerged that he had not been telling the whole story to these officials who were interviewing him. That is required in exchange for the deal that he got down in Georgia. So he was not telling the truth to officials. For example, he was lying to Michigan officials who had interviewed him, who he was supposed to be helping, about the fact that he had an anonymous Twitter account that he had used to spread fake claims about the 2020 election. When he was asked directly about that, he said, "Oh, no." When he was asked if he had any other Twitter accounts or whatever, social media accounts that we didn't know about, he said no. Well, he absolutely did. The complaint portrays Chesbro as generating a series of increasingly aggressive legal theories, all based around the fake electors' plan to prevent the election from being resolved for as long as possible. Troupas, the former Wisconsin state judge, then sent those ideas to the Trump campaign, which then selected Mike Roman to help implement the fake elector slates in the several battleground states. It was a plan originally developed for Wisconsin, and then it went, they thought it was such a great idea to commit this massive election fraud. In fact, it was such a great idea, let's do it in all the states that Donald Trump lost. By January 6th of 2021, the complaint says, Chesbro, Troupas, and Roman were working together to ensure that the fake Trump elector certificates made it to then-Vice President Mike Pence, who would be presiding over the certification of Electoral College votes during the joint session of Congress to confirm the final results of the 2020 presidential election. The Wisconsin charges mark the first time that Troupas has faced charges for his involvement in the fake elector scheme. Chesbro, however, as I noted, pleaded guilty in Georgia in the Fulton County, Georgia RICO case last year, before agreeing to cooperate in several other state probes. Roman faces charges already in both Georgia and Arizona, and now in Wisconsin over his involvement. He is scheduled to be arraigned in Arizona on Friday this week. Photos and messages released in a separate civil lawsuit in Wisconsin against Chesbro and Troupas show the Trump attorney, Chesbro, was actually present. There's photographs of him at the state's fake electors meeting on December 14. Chesbro has not settled that case, but the that civil case, but the electors themselves, well, they admitted in their own settlement that yes, in fact, the effort was a sham, and they knew it was a sham, that Trump in fact had lost and that the effort was a con. They admitted to that. Chesbro has yet to do that. During a news conference in Madison on Tuesday, Wisconsin Attorney General Call said the state's investigation into the matter was continuing, suggesting that there may still be more charges ahead, either for the defendants or potentially for others. He declined to elaborate, but in total now, 52 people have been charged in criminal cases in five separate states stemming from this particular plot, and there were many, but this particular plot, the fake electors plot to steal the 2020 election for Trump, that group of 52 people is headlined by, yes, Trump himself, who was indicted last year in Georgia under the RICO law down there, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act law. And he also faces a federal election interference case, of course. He was also named as an unindicted co-conspirator in Michigan in the fake electors case up there, though the attorney general's office in that state has recently described Trump's unindicted status as, quote, for now. He's unindicted for now in Michigan. So, yeah, could still be some more charges for Donald Trump in the days ahead. Meanwhile, Wisconsin's Governor Tony Evers, a Democrat, praised the charges against Trump's allies with a one-word statement on Tuesday. Quote, good, said Evers, whose office pointed out that he had been calling for those involved in the fake electors plot to be held accountable for a long, long time, as has already happened in criminal charges brought in Arizona and Georgia and Nevada and Michigan and, yes, now Wisconsin. As luck would have it, Wisconsin will host the Republican National Convention next month in Milwaukee. Next month. There, Trump is scheduled to accept the party's presidential nomination just days after he is set to be sentenced in his New York hush money case on July 11, after a Manhattan jury on Thursday last week convicted him on all 34 felony counts. So, yeah, there are some Democrats on trial for personal corruption being held to account by a Democratic-led Justice Department. And those Democrats have largely been disowned by their own party. But there is a broad and ongoing plot by the entire Republican Party to undermine the rule of law itself, the constitutional order itself, and the nation itself this year through the election of a former president under indictment or conviction on some 90 felony charges. As dozens and dozens of his henchmen are only just now beginning to face accountability for their parts in the failed plot to overthrow the last election, to overthrow the nation itself, and to steal a presidential election back in 2020. And yes, they hope to do it again if they can get away with it this time, when they've had much more time for planning in 2024. I could cite all kinds of concerns that I personally have with Joe Biden and with the Democratic Party. But frankly, those concerns miss the point by a mile, in a year like this one, at a moment in history like this one. As historian and documentarian Ken Burns, one of his documentaries famously is on the Civil War, as Ken Burns made very clear in remarks during his commencement speech to graduates at Brandeis University in Massachusetts last month.
Which brings me to a moment I've dreaded and forces me to suspend my longstanding attempt at neutrality. There is no real choice this November. There is only the perpetuation, however flawed and feeble you might perceive it, of our fragile 249-year-old experiment, or the entropy that will engulf and destroy us if we take the other route. When, as Mercy Otis Warren would say, the checks of conscience are thrown aside and a deformed picture of the soul is revealed. The presumptive Republican nominee is the opioid of all opioids, an easy cure for what some believe is the solution to our myriad pains and problems, when in fact, with him, you end up re-enslaved with an even bigger problem, a worse affliction and addiction, a bigger delusion, James Baldwin would say, the author and finisher of our national existence, our national suicide, as Mr. Lincoln prophesies. Do not be seduced by easy equalization. There is nothing equal about this equation. We are at an existential crossroads in our political and civic lives. This is a choice that could not be clearer.
Historian and a documentarian, Ken Burns, speaking just last month at Brandeis University, warning, do not be seduced by easy equalization. There is nothing equal here. As we head toward what he described Lincoln as describing as a national suicide. So, yeah. It's easy to, you know, they're all bad. They're all terrible. Let's get rid of all of them. Well, okay, maybe if that was possible, but it ain't. And by the way, for no good reason to get rid of all of them, because a lot of them are doing really good and really important work. But this is not, do not be seduced by easy equalization. And that goes for all of us, especially those of us in the media who really feel it's necessary to equalize everything. If we're going to have a bad story about Republicans, we need to have an equal bad story about Democrats. No, that's not the situation we are now in. So pay attention, people. Because this year, it really matters. Let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with some largely good news on a bizarre story that we have been covering for weeks, for actually months at this point on this program, plus a plot twist in it, or related to it, that I certainly did not see coming, a plot twist that could be bad news for Trump following his felony convictions in New York last week. And, of course, Desi Doyen's latest Green News report. All of that is ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. So remember that story about Ohio that I wasn't sure if it was even worth covering back in, I think it was April or so when I started covering that day.
Yeah,
do you remember
I think
that? I didn't even know if it was worth covering it because it was such a ridiculous scheme at the time by Ohio's Republican lawmakers that would keep Joe Biden off of this year's presidential ballot in the Buckeye State because the Republicans refused to extend the deadline for when a presidential candidate must be certified by their party in order to qualify for the ballot in Ohio. You know, the same law that where they had extended that same deadline to ensure that, Mitt Romney back in 2012 and Donald Trump back in 2020 would be able to qualify for the ballot even though their national party's nominating conventions were not held in those years until after the statutory deadline in Ohio. So it seemed so stupid at the time. I thought it would be easily taken care of. I wasn't even sure if it was worth covering. All it required was a legislative fix by the state legislature, just like they had done in 2012 and had done in 2020, etc. Well, they didn't fix it. And it went on and on. And the session ended. The legislative session ended. And they still had not come up with a solution to this completely manufactured problem. Well, apparently we have finally got an ending to that ridiculous story now, at least I think. Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine on Sunday signed a measure to ensure that President Joe Biden will, in fact, appear on the state ballot in November. DeWine signed the measure, which relaxes the state candidate filing deadline, along with an only tangentially related bill that imposes a ban on foreign nationals contributing to state ballot campaigns. That was one of the holdups. The Republicans refused to pass this unless it had this ban on foreign nationals contributing to state ballot campaigns. Now, the Republican-dominated legislature had approved both of those measures last week during a rare special session that had to be called by the Republican Governor Mike DeWine in order to deal with this issue. For one thing, Republicans didn't like not having Joe Biden on the ballot because, you know, they, at least some of them in Ohio, they said this is, you know, we want him on the ballot because it forces our voters to come out to vote against him. But this contribution ban had been demanded by Republicans in the state Senate, which approved the measures, both of the measures, on Friday, a day after the House had passed both of them. The contribution ban also broadened the definition of, quote, foreign nationals in order to include lawful permanent residents of the United States, often known as green card holders. Well, why did they do that? Well, as state Democrats in the House pointed out, Republicans who have supermajorities in both of the state legislative chambers successfully exploited this conundrum regarding Biden and the ballot in order to pass this unrelated bill that undermines direct democracy in Ohio, undermines ballot initiatives, where voters had sided against GOP leaders' prevailing positions by huge margins on three separate ballot measures last year. And that made the Republicans mad. Those measures included protecting abortion access in the state constitution, turning back a proposal to make it harder to pass such constitutional amendments in the future, and legalizing recreational marijuana, all of which were approved by voters by large margins. And so Republicans are mad about that. Political committees involved in the first two efforts, the protecting abortion access and then turning back proposals to make it harder to pass any constitutional amendments in the future. Some organizations that were involved in passing those two efforts apparently took money from entities that had received donations over the past decade from a guy named Hans-Jörg Weiss, or Weiss, a Swiss billionaire. Even though any direct path from him to the Ohio campaigns is untraceable under campaign finance laws that were left unaddressed by Republicans in the House. Apparently, Ohio Republicans want to keep campaign money untraceable. But in any event, the foreign national they're targeting here, Weiss, actually lives in Wyoming. He has lived in Wyoming for years. He has a green card. He's a permanent resident at this point of the U.S. But apparently he gave some money to some groups over many years. Those groups ended up supporting the committee that put this thing on the ballot to protect abortion rights in Ohio. And the Republicans are mad about that. And that's what this bill is all about. And that's why they were holding President Biden hostage and his place on the ballot hostage. So they could add in this foreign national thing here.
I mean, yeah, that's the real reason that they were just exploiting the whole Biden deadline problem, just so that they could then interfere and monkey wrench ordinary voters in Ohio their ability to get a statewide ballot initiative passed.
Going after
this one guy.
Of course. The contribution ban measure has the potential to affect ballot issues that are making their way towards Ohio's November 5 ballot this year, including proposed changes to Ohio's redistricting law, raising the minimum wage to $15, granting qualified immunity for police, and protecting certain voting rights. The provision was added to the House bill, with proponents saying it would close, quote, a glaring loophole in the bill, but several lawmakers questioned whether it eventually would lead to the courts striking down the entire measure as unconstitutional. The special session was ostensibly called by DeWine to address the fact that Ohio's deadline for making the November ballot falls on August 7. That is 2 weeks before the Democratic president will be formally nominated at the party's August 19 convention in Chicago. State lawmakers had failed for months to simply change the deadline with a simple fix, as they had done in years past for the Republican presidential candidates. But when the Senate and then DeWine's proclamation calling lawmakers back to Columbus for the special session tied the issue of Biden on the ballot to the foreign nationals' prohibition, well, the DNC said the hell with it. They moved to neutralize the need for any vote by Ohio Republican lawmakers. So they agreed, the DNC, with the Biden campaign to solve the problem with a virtual roll call vote to nominate Biden online in advance of the Ohio deadline and in advance of the actual Democratic National Convention. The DNC has said it's planning to have that virtual roll call anyway, to move forward with it anyway, even though DeWine has now signed the bill. And all of that came after Republicans had been up in arms following the Colorado Supreme Court ruling late last year, finding that Donald Trump was disqualified from the state's ballot for his violation of the U.S. Constitution's insurrection disqualification clause. They were furious about that. And of course, that ruling, after a trial and everything else in Colorado, was subsequently overturned by Donald Trump's friends and appointees on the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, who had to make up a reason out of whole cloth to completely ignore the text, the simple text of Section 3 of the Constitution's 14th Amendment, in order to ensure that Trump would be on the Colorado ballot. At the time, the the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a state cannot, on their own, remove a presidential candidate, even if he or she violates the simple text barring insurrectionists from office in the U.S. Constitution. They just made that up out of whole cloth. No, you can't apply this. We got a new rule. But following last week's jury verdict in New York, finding Donald Trump guilty of 34 felony crimes in New York. Well, we have a plot twist today. A plot twist, as it was described by the Seattle Times columnist Danny Westneat, courtesy of the the law in Washington state. Westneat writes, if local Republicans knew what was good for them, they would now move to drop Donald Trump from Washington's fall ballot. He says, I know they won't. They're in too deep. Trump won 76% of our state's GOP presidential primary vote. It's become like a cult, as the party seems eager to debase itself by shedding all of its longstanding talk about the rule of law and personal responsibility, as well as any chances of winning in Washington state, in order to sink even deeper into the muck of Trump. So here's another reason to dump Trump from the Washington ballot, Westneat explains. If Republicans don't do it, somebody else probably will, he says. It turns out Washington state has a law on the books against convicted felons running for office. Oops. Sam Alito, Clarence Thomas, start your engines. Or turn your flags upside down, or whatever the hell it is you pretend patriots do. The law in Washington was apparently first established back when it was a territory in 1865. You know, at the founding of the state, when guys like Alito say all laws must, you know, begin to actually have to start at the beginning of the beginning in order to actually count. The law says that anyone convicted of, quote, infamous crimes could be blocked from holding elected office. That was modified in 1959. And again, the law was modified more recently to the scheme that is in play today. According to the state law, any registered voter can, quote, challenge the right of a candidate to appear on the general election ballot for any of five causes. One of those causes is because the person whose right is being contested was previous to the election convicted of a felony by a court of competent jurisdiction. Westneat writes, how about 34 felonies? He cites a Seattle attorney and former deputy prosecutor for King County, David Vogel, who said, quote, I have clients who are going to be all over pursuing a ballot challenge in this case. States, in fact, do have latitude to control the ballot, notes Westneat. Candidates for president are excluded from Washington's ballot all the time, though it typically happens to minor party candidates who didn't follow filing deadlines or didn't meet the requirements to hold the office. Well, now one of the requirements, apparently, is not being a felon. Washington law says a voter can file Any voter can file a challenge once candidates are certified to appear on the fall ballot, which for presidential races typically occurs, though not this year in Ohio, after the party's national nominating conventions are done over the summer. That voter challenge goes to, quote, any justice of the Supreme Court, judge of the Court of Appeals, judge of the Superior Court in the proper county, who, according to state statute, can potentially strip a candidate's name from ballots prior to the election if they have a felony conviction. Hoo boy, writes Westneat. Republicans, you sure you want to go down this road? He asks, once again, suggesting maybe, just maybe, they may want to rethink officially nominating a 34-time convicted felon to be their standard bearer this fall, adding, I wonder if other states bar felons from running, too. Maybe they do. It seems possible, he said, that under Washington state law, there would be no name listed on ballots as a Republican candidate for president in November. If so, it will be because the party's chosen candidate was too much of a disgrace to even meet the minimum state standards. Regardless of what happens with the ballot, why not change course out of basic decency and political expediency, he asks. There's been plenty of talk urging Democrats to drop Biden and pick another candidate at their nominating convention, and all he's guilty of is having bad poll numbers and being old. Why aren't Republicans at least considering a different candidate now that theirs is a convicted criminal? It's not too late to pick a different name, he says, to run a under a less toxic, now criminal brand. He says, I'll leave you with this. Of all states to have a law that can kick convicted felons off the ballot, it's ironic it's Washington. You'd think our progressive state may have been more reform-minded, that the ballot rules might have been recast at some point to extend more mercy and second chances to those who broke bad and got caught in the jaws of the justice system. Instead, the script has flipped, he notes. It's now the old Law and Order party who are looking for leniency as it continues to shed its principles, its entire identity, to follow this one man further into the mire. Well done. He had more to say. I will link to that story by Danny Westneat at the Seattle Times. But speaking of the mire, yeah, it's getting thick out there around the planet, as our cichlid Desi Doyen will explain in our latest Green News Report. That's straight ahead here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. The Bradcast survives thanks to you and your support. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us continue to do over your public airwaves what we try to do 5 days a week. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Okay, COVID girl, I don't know how you even made it through it, but let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
Entire neighborhoods resemble ghost towns. Pavements are empty, parks are quiet, school playgrounds are silent. Nobody with a choice ventures outside.
Dangerous heat smothers India. Power outages in the U.S. have doubled over the last 20 years. Plus,
the victim is not the one that's responsible to pay. It's the offender.
Vermont enacts first-in-the-nation polluter pays law, requiring big oil to pay for climate damages.
About damn time. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Who even two cases of COVID in 2 weeks can't keep down. Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
As industry experts will tell you, it doesn't matter what your thoughts on climate change are, because your insurance company believes it and has to be ready for it in order to stay in business.
Wow. NBC Miami now sounds like Desi Doyen. About damn time. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, we've been off for a week. You're sick again, so
yes.
I'll let you get right to it, and I'll look the other way so you don't breathe on me.
All right. Well, while we were out, I just want to note that over the Memorial Day holiday weekend, multiple powerful storms killed at least 26 people across several states and knocked out electricity for days amid early season heat waves. A new analysis from nonprofit data firm Climate Central finds that power outages in the U.S. have doubled since 2001. 80% of all major power outages in the United States now are due to weather, underscoring that the U.S. electric grid was not built for 21st century climate impacts. A different study warns that in coming decades, an increasing number of U.S. cities will suffer temperatures high enough to overheat electrical equipment and compromise power transformers, causing more frequent, dangerous blackouts.
Even more frequent than they've become already.
Yes, states most at risk in coming decades are California, Arizona, Nevada, and Texas. June 1st marked the official start of the Atlantic hurricane season. Forecasters warn that Atlantic Ocean heat, which fuels hurricanes, has never been greater heading into a hurricane season. Ocean temperatures are already at levels typical of August, with the oceans even hotter now than at this time last year.
And, of course, the warmer oceans mean more intensified storms.
Yes. Truly dangerous heat is gripping northern India, testing the limits of human endurance. Delhi set a new all-time high temperature record of at least 122 degrees Fahrenheit last week.
Really?
Drinking water supplies have dried up in the poorest areas. In India also just wrapped up a major election amid the heat wave. Scores have died from heat stroke, including at least 30 poll workers. On the plus side, a new analysis finds that India has built nearly five times more solar energy in the first quarter of 2024 than it deployed in all of 2023.
They didn't cause the problem, but hey, at least they're trying to do something about it.
In Britain, a major milestone, wind power was the nation's largest source of electricity in the first quarter of 2024, overtaking natural gas.
Very cool.
And Mexico elected its first female president, Claudia Sheinbaum, a climate and energy scientist and a contributor to the UN's Global Climate Assessments. It may not be a coincidence that Dr. Sheinbaum was elected during a weeks-long, record-shattering heat wave and persistent drought. Mexico City neighborhoods are being forced to ration water as the drought-stricken city grapples with a water shortage crisis. Mexico City faces the very real prospect of running out of water in a matter of weeks. Experts warn it is a bellwether of how worsening climate change could affect cities all over the world.
Will affect cities all over the world.
Finally, in the wake of catastrophic floods last year, Vermont has become the first state in the nation to enact a polluter pays law, requiring fossil fuel companies to compensate the state for the destruction caused by man-made climate change, which is driven by the burning of fossil fuels.
About damn time!
The law creates a climate superfund, modeled after the federal superfund program, that empowers the state attorney general to pursue payment from big corporations like ExxonMobil and Shell. In a press conference, Democratic State Senator Ann Watson cited rising damages that are costing the state billions every year.
But let's be clear. Vulnerable Vermonters, mom-and-pop businesses, and small cities and towns aren't the cause of this damage. Big Oil knew decades ago that their products would cause this damage. So it is only right that they pay a share of the cost to clean up this mess.
Big Oil is expected to fight the law in court.
Oh, I bet they are, and I bet the U.S. Supreme Court is going to try to find any way they can to help them. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Okay. All right. It's about damn time.
It is about damn time.
Yep.
About damn time we get the hell out of here. Thanks to our, thank you, Des. Good job. Congratulations making it through that. That's our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. That's made possible by those of you kind enough to go to Bradblog and hit one of those donate buttons, or just go straight to bradblog.com/donate. We really appreciate and need your support. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at TheBradBlog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.